with the Agricultural Research Service. I'm co-located there on Auburn University. Lonnie Banting gave a good introduction to the systems that I'm typically working in, really high residue systems. We're looking a lot of times comparing winter fallow or some type of tillage system to high residue. Sometimes we're looking at systems where we vary the amounts of residue. We also are looking at tillage implements and how to reduce the amount of surface disturbance we do in those systems. Through this slide in here with the tomato transplanter, we work in major row crops, but we also look at vegetable research. And the upper corner up here kind of shows you the extreme of what sometimes our systems look like with the amount of residue. This is a producer in southwest Alabama, Jimmy Brooks, and he manages about 2,500 acres this way. This picture was actually taken just prior to a field day where he was demonstrating some of the roller technology that we've stolen from the Brazilians to manage the amounts of residue sometimes that we're looking at. Just a brief overview of the benefits of conservation tillage that include cover crops. We've seen people have documented enhanced water infiltration and availability, increased soil productivity, increased organic matter, increased nutrient cycling, and then also suppression of early season weed growth, which is the aspect that I'm interested in looking at. Of course, with any system, there are limitations, and conservation ag certainly has those. Prohibits the use of broadcast pre-plant incorporated herbicides. If you have a substantial amount of residue, you're going to have interference of that residue with your soil applied herbicides. We've seen weed population composition shifts. And then in systems which rely heavily on Roundup Ready technology, which has driven the adoption of conservation ag, we've seen the development of herbicide resistance. Again, with the adoption of glyphosate technology, we've seen the increase of resistance, and of course, one of the major problems and fears in Alabama is resistant Palmer amaranth that was discovered in Georgia in 2005 and has since been documented in Tennessee, North Carolina, Arkansas. I saw on one of the slides South Carolina. Recently, Dr. Patterson bought me some seed from Eufaula, Alabama, which is just three counties west of where Stanley's documented it in Georgia. Another location in South Alabama that we're going to be evaluating here in the next month to verify whether or not the problem is now in our state. Just kind of briefly describe to you that the growers in Alabama were about 70% or greater conservation ag. About 30% of those use some type of 30% use some type of cover crop. At our Alabama Farmers Federation meeting, some of the major questions that the cotton producers have are, you know, how are we going to deal with this problem when we get it? And we have producers that have been in conservation ag for a long enough time that they're not willing to think about tillage, even though that might be an option for some growers. They'd like to have a solution for their place. This is just an extension handout from Stanley's website over in Georgia. And he has on here a statement, there are no economical management programs for fields infested with glyphosate-resistant Palmer amaranth. And again, this is what our, you know, is worst case scenario for our farmers in conservation ag, is what are they going to do? You saw in Stanley's talk how, you know, he did some cultivation, and that really helped them out. So we're trying to figure out in our systems, how can we survive? This is a slide that is summarizing a study that was done before my arrival to Auburn. And this is a study that Mike Patterson there at Auburn University did in conjunction with Dr. Wayne Reeves, who's an agronomist with USDA, who was once at Auburn and is now in Georgia. And what they were really looking at was the effect of high residue winter cover crop. And they had black oats, wheat, rye, and fallow. And this is in a soybean study. And then you can look down here on the bottom axis. They had three herbicide systems. They had a no herbicide, a low herbicide input system, and a high. And the low input system had post only, and the high had pre and post. and then you have your weed biomass on the left axis. And really the thing to notice here was in the high residue systems that had black oat or rye, they had very little early season weed competition. And you can see what I'm talking about in the picture here. This is actually, there are soybeans under this, but what you see is Palmer amaranth. And this is a study down in Wiregrass, which is southeast Alabama. And you can see that where there wasn't any disturbance, there weren't any Palmer amaranth, Palmer pigweed there, and where the planter went through the residue, there was, you know, you can see what type of population was there. So again, looking at this slide, trying to integrate what can we do to potentially solve that problem. So we came up with an experiment where we had five management systems. Four of those were conservation tillage systems. Three had winter rye at three different levels. We had an early, a mid, and a late planting date to generate those amounts of rye. We had a winter fallow conservation tillage system, and we had a conventional tillage system. The conventional tillage system was not an inversion tillage. We did multiple passes with a disc. We had this, skip down to the bottom, the locations. We had this at E.V. Smith, which is mid-latitude Alabama, kind of southwest of Auburn, and then in the Tennessee Valley, which is near Huntsville. At Tennessee Valley, we are direct seeding up there. We don't have to do any tillage when we use a cover crop. And then at our E.V. Smith location, we were doing narrow strip tillage, similar to what was in that second slide, where we just were using the pneumatic tires to close the subsoil slots. We were disturbing the very minimal amount of surface residue. Then we across we had those in one strip, and then across that we had four herbicide regimes. We had pre-emergence application of dual broadcast, followed by post-application of glyphosate, followed by a lay-by of Direx plus MSMA. Then we had the same treatment, but we had the pre-banded. Then we had a post-ball followed by a lay-by only, or followed by a lay-by and then a lay-by only treatment. At each of the locations, we had a native red root pigweed population in Tennessee Valley, and then we had Palmer amaranth at E.V. Smith. Neither of these populations is resistant. And also, we wanted to make sure we had an adequate seed bank, so we added an extra 120,000 seeds per plot just to make sure that we had out there what we wanted. And then to some of our evaluations included our pigweed density and biomass. We evaluated this at our four-leaf cotton stage before we put on our post-application, and then we did it prior to and after our lay-by applications. Moving on to the results. Most of these slides are going to be set up similar, where we have on the left axis our rye biomass. On our bottom axis, we have our tillage system, where we have plant date 1, plant date 2, plant date 3 for our rye cover crops. WF stands for the winter fallow, and then the CT is our conventional tillage. On the right axis, we have on this slide pigweed density. So at Tennessee Valley, we can see that we generated our three different amounts of rye with our three planting dates, ranging from above 6,000 kilograms per hectare to almost 9. And then we didn't have, obviously, any residue in the winter fallow or conservation tillage plots. And then the orange dots represent the pigweed density. And you can see that we had the highest amount of pigweed germinated in our winter fallow plot. Second was our conventional tillage plot and our plant day 3 conservation ag plot. And then we had fewer where we had higher residue. This is the corresponding biomass to those densities, and you can see that we again had the highest biomass in our winter fallow and our conventional tillage plot, and then we had very little biomass in the pigweed that were in the conventional ag plots, just kind of illustrating that while some of them were there, that they must have been pretty small. Looking at E.V. Smith, we had a similar trend in that our winter fallow and conventional tillage plot had the highest levels of pigweed densities. And then what was different here was, and again, this was where we had Palmer amaranth versus the red root at the other location. that it didn't matter how much residue we had out there, it didn't really impact the density below the reduction we got. We got a reduction, but it didn't matter how much residue we had. And looking at the biomass, what's interesting here is what pigweed we had, they were larger. So we were having some healthy growth of the pigweed that were in the plots with heavy residue. And we can kind of, you know, discuss what that might be caused by. Again, you know, the attributes of the conservation ag systems, you know, maybe there was more moisture under those amounts of residue, and therefore they had, you know, higher biomass. Looking late season density at Tennessee Valley, you can see that in general we had the same trends as before, except that in plant date 3, our density skyrocketed. And we likely didn't have enough residue there to suppress the growth of the pigweed there, but we might have been providing enough moisture conservation. I should mention at both of these locations, for our entire season, Alabama's been in an exceptional drought on the U.S. drought monitor. So you can these results may be different next year when we have adequate moisture. Looking at the biomass, again, what's noticeable here is where we had fewer pigweed, we actually grew some really big pigweed. Again, is that because we had residue that was protecting soil moisture or other attributes? That's for discussion. But and then at E.B. Smith, again, the densities reflected kind of similar to the early season. But again, where we had the most residue, you can see we had the fewest pigweed. And the biomass corresponded, again, what's noticeable is a plant date 1 and 2, where we did have fewer pigweed, that they were larger. And so we did have a more substantial biomass. One of the things we were trying to do with not only the amounts of residue and the densities and the herbicide regimes, which weren't significant because we didn't get much rainfall and activate the residual herbicides, was to do kind of what Andrew did in the classical competition study, and that was to generate different densities and biomass, and maybe we could get a yield response. But one thing we didn't find was that cotton yield really didn't respond to our populations or our densities, and it really mainly responded to our tillage factor. You can see that our conventional tillage yielded less than those that had no-till. And then biomass was the same. There was no trend, no relationship between pigweed density and yield. And the same thing for E.B. Smith. So in conclusion, the increasing amounts of winter cover can decrease early season pigweed density. The systems that utilize high residue winter cover have increased, that do not use the high residue, such as the winter fallow or when you late to plant your cover crop, you may have increased pigweed densities. Okay. The weed control provided by the tillage is similar to that of conservation ag systems that have moderate amounts of residue. So again, you know, when you get light penetration and there's not enough residue there to actually inhibit the pigweed growth, you are seeing those pigweed not only germinate but thrive. And then systems with the maximum levels of residue did have fewer pigweed. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Again, hopefully next year we'll have some moisture and some of the herbicide regimes maybe will play into the results we found. But I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions for our speaker?
Sure. Tom asked me to comment on the types of rollers we have. Initially kind of stole this technology from Brazil, who Brazilian ag use the cover crop rollers in many of their systems. And the initial ones we brought were kind of rough on the seat when you use them at high speeds and were fairly effective, but tended to beat themselves apart. And so Randy, actually, who came in, one of our engineers, has a patent for one of the spiral rollers that we're tending to use now that you can go as fast as your tractor can take you.
Any other questions?
Thank you.